From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Welcome to Soundings, Television and American Culture. That's the topic this week on Soundings. My guest is Todd Gitlin, a professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley. Todd Gitlin recently participated in a conference at the National Humanities Center entitled Television and History. He is the editor of a collection of essays, Watching Television, published this year by Pantheon Books.
Talk to me for a few minutes about soap operas on television. What's going on?
Soap operas are, of course, the dominant medium of the day, daytime, and there's a long history of this sort of thing. What Ruth Rosen's essay in the book talks about is the way in which the soap opera in the day constructs a sort of ideal small town in which people are, for all of their kinkiness and quirkiness and intermixing, finally just folks intermixing and conserving verities.
This sounds like some sort of an idol. Don't we watch soap operas to get the real dope about how people behave? And
well, we watch soap operas for complicated reasons, as we do all sorts of things. And we watch people do kinky things in order to watch them redeemed. I mean, in a way, there's something very moralistic about the soap opera. And you can have your sin and eat it when you watch a soap. you can watch folks do sinful things and vicariously enjoy that, at the same time enjoy the process by which they're brought back into the fold. And everyone is eventually brought back into the fold.
You told me before we did our taping that soap operas constitute fundamentally a sort of conservative view of the world. How is that?
Well, because eventually everyone is brought back into the fold.
Redemption.
Yeah, everyone is redeemed. And there are other things, too. There's a technical feature of the soap opera. Everyone has to be technically free to couple with everyone else. And this creates a kind of frisson of excitement, right? Sexual excitement.
If we have that freedom, how do we reconcile that with the notion that it is a fundamentally conservative ethos that we're looking at? There's a contradiction there.
There is a curious thing that follows from the fact that everyone has to be free to couple with everyone else. The soap opera, therefore, the way they're done in the U.S. today, for all of the sexual looseness that took place, there is still a reluctance to show interracial or interethnic marriage, or affairs.
Yeah.
So the upshot is that actually you see very few people who are not white Anglo-Saxon Protestants in the show. Mm-hmm. If they were there, you see, they would have to be available for coupling, since being available for coupling runs the risk of offense, or so the networks think.
So what we've got here is an exclusion, not so much a censorship.
Well, exactly. And that's the way television works. It's always fearful. I mean, commercial television is fearful of alienating some big block of viewers because the premium is on maximum audience count.
All right. Now, speaking of big blocks of viewers, tell me about music television. One of the essays in this book that you've edited is about MTV. Strange phenomenon.
This essay actually is by Pat Alfterheide, who's been teaching part-time at Duke, as it happens. Her argument, I think, is very interesting. Here's this form in which the traditional character does not exist. Mm-hmm. Instead of fixed character, you have a kind of protean, weird transformations, Kafka-esque transformations. A character may start a music video as a sailor and then turn into a smuggler and then turn into a disco dancer and eventually back, you know, into a congressman or a street wino.
I see a lot of mannequins. I see a lot of mannequin kinds of things.
Yes, kind of stylized, fixed. Uh-huh. Well, okay, both the mannequin and this sort of fluid figure are alternatives to traditional character.
Uh-huh.
And what she argues is that this is consonant with a world in which teenagers have a sort of shopping mall view of identity. They really don't have a firm sense of self. Uh-huh. And these shifting figures, these shifting images, give them back a world in which you don't have to be firm. You don't have to be fixed. You can go with the flow.
This sounds like a pernicious kind of thing that's going on. Isn't there anybody who's standing up and saying, wait a minute, this is wrong, or it needs to be criticized? Is it simply there, another one of our commercial phenomena?
Well, she does think it's pernicious. Some people argued when MTV appeared that, well, after all, finally here's a medium that's distinctively televisual. Mm-hmm. Here's finally television's doing something that just can't be ignored.
All surface.
All surface, exactly. Somebody once said that television was moving wallpaper, and here's a form of television which doesn't pretend to be anything else.
Uh-huh.
Is anybody standing up and saying they don't like it? Actually, I think for the wrong reasons. I think the people who have been critical of MTV have taken a very superficial aspect of it, namely a sort of glitzy sexuality or pseudo-sexuality, especially the ones with the kinky lyrics.
Uh-huh.
I think that's actually probably a red herring.
And what we need
mostly
to look,
the lyrics aren't audible.
Yeah, what we need to look at are what a 50-cent term here: philosophical, larger cultural reasons to either endorse it or criticize it.
Well, I agree. Too much of the discussion about television in this country focuses on the very easy things. All right, how many inches of exposed flesh there are, how many people beat each other over the head, how many dirty words, and so on. That's a spurious argument, I think, or at least a superficial one.
Well, one of the things that you're telling me here, Todd Gitlin, we've talked about soap operas, we're now talking about music television. Both of these are topics that appear in this book that you've just published, Watching Television, is that TV is not necessarily the great big villain that we think it is, because it looks to other forms, it looks to other models in our culture for what it does. Now, we got a two-way street going on here. Let's turn, for example, to what you call simulations. Are we on the right track with that, that television is looking to other models in our culture for what it does?
Michael Sorkin's essay on simulations actually argues that here are these things in television which capitalize on the fact that people are puzzled about what is authentic or not.
Uh-huh.
He identifies a number of things that you wouldn't ordinarily think as having anything to do with each other. For example,
instance,
Mr. T,
does
he mean it or not? Okay.
Yeah.
Lip-syncing contests,
right,
in which teenagers mimic Madonna, etc., and get points for quote-unquote originality. This is truly something.
Air guitar contests.
Things
like that. Well, right. So what's
people's
wrong with that?
It's not that there's anything wrong with it. He's not arguing there's anything wrong with it. Again, this is a piece, like several in this book, which say, look, there's something curious going on in this culture,
mm-hmm,
that the line between the real and the unreal, or the authentic and the simulated, has gotten blurred. And audiences have become adept at looking at something which isn't clearly either real or not. This is distinct to maybe the 20th century, or maybe especially this moment.
Mm-hmm.
It's as if all these shows are winking at you and saying, we do or don't mean it. Anyway, don't ask. Don't bother me with such old-fashioned questions.
Well, not only do we have a blur in the line between what's real and what's unreal, we have a blurring in television as cause and television as effect. Television as a symptom of our society, or television as a shaper of our society?
Well, these discussions tend not to be clear about what they mean by television. They mean just something that's in a box in the corner of the room?
Yeah.
No.
Uh-huh.
Television is a social fact, and it's produced by an industry. People watch it who also do other things and are sometimes doing other things while they watch it. It's produced by people who also live, eat, make love, marry, divorce, read newspapers, read magazines, go on vacations. I mean, I think it's necessary to see television as a social world, as a mm-hmm social loop that both extracts things that are already in the culture and gives them back.
Uh-huh.
I sometimes think of television's relation to the culture this way, that culture is a sort of soup. People think, feel, or inclined to think, see, etc., all kinds of things. There are the whole society, especially this one, this culture is so diverse and complicated and self-contradictory that there are mood, people feel tough, people feel soft, people feel angry, people feel weak. All these things are going on. Television, like other forms of popular culture, takes this sort of soup and crystallizes things out of it.
Well, not only
and then it puts it on the screen so that people look at this and say, aha, oh yes, Archie Bunker and Mike correspond to what's going on, the big generational fight in this country. Right. I see that immediately. You know? Cosby and his family represent something that's going on. And that's what it does. So that doesn't mean that television's unimportant.
Mm-hmm.
It's extremely important because it by putting this soup into crystalline form, it enables people to recognize it.
Well, it not only...
But it doesn't mean that television's making things up out of thin air. That's the important
thing. Fair enough. I was going to say, it doesn't mean that television... It not only crystallizes things, it reduces things.
Often it does.
There is a reductivity here that is very dangerous.
I agree. And especially to the extent that people take the medium seriously, mm-hmm. and they think that the news is, for example... What is really going on in the world
when it's
in fact a version of the world.
Let's talk about television journalism. What should we know about this immense influence, this immense availability of information around us ABC tells us uniquely qualified to bring you the world. Dan Rather is supposed to be our avuncular, sort of an oracular source of information. Clearly, those are exaggerations in the service of hyping the news.
Right.
But there's also something serious about these promotional announcements.
Well, in fact, Dan Hallin's piece on news in the Watching Television book is called We Keep America on Top of the World, which is the CBS slogan.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that everyone swallows that whole.
Yeah.
But what needs to be understood better is that television news is an industrial product. It's produced by organizations that see certain things and don't see other things,
mm-hmm.
and that come to realities with certain dispositions.
Has it become too much of an entertainment kind of thing? That's one of the things that we discussed before our taping
session. News has never been free of entertainment. Sometimes these discussions start from the false premise that once upon a time
in the
golden age of Edward R. Murrow or the golden days of newspapers, I don't know what that means, William Hearst, the Yellow Press. But anyway, there was some golden age sometime when news told it straight, and now it's gotten giddy. Well, that's nonsense. The news has always been constructed. It's a form. It tells stories. That's why in news they talk about the story. They don't mm-hmm. say, here are the facts. They say, here's the story.
Yeah.
So, and yet, I think it's also true that the entertainment element has come more blatantly into the television news. NBC News commissioned John Williams, the author of television themes, of movie themes. Star Wars, etc., to write a special theme that even has a title, The Mission.
Yep.
They have this glitzy Statue of Liberty logo. They have coming attractions now before the news and during the news.
Yep.
They have coming attractions during the morning show for the evening news that's coming up. You have news capsules and news briefs, and then commercials within the news briefs, and then summaries, introductions to the brief, and exits, and so on. So there is this kind of nonstop variety show approach to news. And yet, I think this is not really the fundamental thing.
Well, what is?
The fundamental thing is that the news is a version of reality. It is a window on the world, but not a mirror on it. The whole mirror metaphor is nonsensical. Mirrors are passive. The news opens some windows and others are closed.
Yeah.
I mean, most Americans do not know, for example, that the United States has a policy of the first use of nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
Only something like 19% of Americans know that. Even though 60 million people a night are watching network news, 60 some odd million people a day are reading newspapers.
Well, now wait, you're putting the burden where it doesn't belong. The burden isn't on the networks to tell us that. The burden is on ourselves to go out and figure out what our culture is about and who's making the decisions. We don't have to blame television news for this, do we?
No, there's plenty of burden to go around. I'm not trying to exonerate any institution, nor am I trying to exonerate American culture as a whole. I just choose that as one example. Let me state in a capsule what I would argue about the news. This is not really argued in the piece, but it's what I would argue, that there's enormous discrepancy in America between American power and American knowledge.
Uh-huh.
And this is what creates a dangerous situation. It therefore imposes special obligations on all our institutions, including education, media, etc.
And in this gap between power and knowledge, television is, well, it's a kind of a quirky thing. Sometimes it fills it, and sometimes it simply ignores it.
This is true. And all theories that say flatly television has this effect,
mm-hmm.
they make people tune out or something like that, all such theories are to be suspected.
Mm-hmm.
Television has many effects. contradictory effect. What it did in 1965 is not necessarily what it does in 1985, yeah, et cetera.
It changes. Todd Gitlin, we are talking about a book that you have edited called Watching Television. You're a professor at the University of California. One of the things that you talked about it in this symposium that you've just been here at the Humanities Center to participate in is the series America. Now, at the time that we're taping this session, this is fairly fresh in a lot of people's minds. Tell me, what do you make of this thing? Is it bad news, bad entertainment? Was it the conservative response to the liberal quote-unquote film The Day After? What do we need to know as we look at a series like that and make sense of it?
Actually, there are many interesting things about this series. There's a story of how it came about, which was as a response to The Day After, and then got out of control to the point in which it was eventually 5 hours longer than, mm-hmm, and much less absorbing, I think, than The Day After. What I actually talked about during the conference was not what the show is about, but how people talked about the show.
Mm-hmm.
And I took as an object lesson the hour and a half.
You've deconstructed it. You've removed it from itself.
Well, no, but you see, the interesting thing about this show is that from the time it was announced,
uh-huh,
it was not simply a show, but it was a show surrounded by packaging, and the,
yeah,
packaging included what critics like myself said, mm, what the network said in extenuation, and then what all the newspapers were saying, mm, and what all the actors were saying, and what all the talk shows and what the cartoonists are saying,
so,
and eventually what ABC was saying about it itself.
Well, is the controversy then completely a pseudo-event? It really had nothing to do with what was on America, the series. It was about people's reactions?
It isn't, though, a pseudo-event, because this is a weird way in which America conducts some of its political discussion in this deflected, oblique, strange way with
talking
this bizarre
to ourselves.
Pretext.
Yeah.
Well, the show was, if the show had come on without any announcement, I mean, suppose one night you get home, you turn on your tube and you
Bingo.
See this thing, you say, what is this?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if it were just that, I think the general reaction would be, this is badly made, this is incredibly boring, it's soporific, it is senseless, it is a pastiche, it's,
yeah,
inconsistent, etc. However, it's actually more interesting than that, because it was a touchstone for a kind of political debate that actually just there should be more of. My position about this series, actually, before and as one of the critics who wrote about it in a declamatory way, a denunciatory way, but my position was never that it should not be aired. My position was that we need not less political disputation on television, but more.
Uh-huh.
And if this show were about the Russian invasion of Afghanistan or pressures in Eastern Europe, I wouldn't have a complaint, but I would also want to see lots of other things in the world discussed.
Mm.
I do think it was built on a crackpot premise.
So it may have been a lousy series, but in a way it served a noble end in the sense that it got us talking about politics.
It's a noble end, but it was managed in a way that was not entirely noble.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did during the conference was to analyze the way in which ABC itself managed the controversy with its Ted Koppel-moderated Viewpoint show,
right,
an hour and a half the night after the series. And without wanting to go into a long song and dance about it, if you look at, for example, Koppel's summary statement, you find, I think, the way in which ABC dampened the controversy in a way that ill serves us. What Koppel essentially said was that the fact that ABC has given a few people an hour and a half to yak about this thing on TV shows how free our society is.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we have a lot more to celebrate than we thought. And after all, television so rarely deals with serious ideas that nobody should have any complaints.
Mm-hmm.
Two things I think I would say to this. First of all, these are stupid ideas that deserve denunciation. Secondly, not all ideas are represented, smart or stupid, and you should ask questions. We should all be asking questions about why it is that a few people have the power to put 14 and some odd hours of television to this use and not others. In other words, the issue that ABC didn't want us to be talking about is, where does ABC derive its authority to do this? Now, in 1934, I hope this is not already a signal to turn off the set, but where I wax a little professorial here, but I think this is something that's not widely understood, and radio listeners might be particularly interested in this. American media are basically still governed, electronic media, under the Communications Act of 1934.
Right.
And when that was being debated by the Senate, an amendment was moved, which would have provided that one quarter of all radio frequencies would be reserved for the use of educational, religious, labor, agricultural, and other nonprofit organizations.
Mm-hmm.
In 1934, that amendment got 20-some-odd votes. It was defeated. It got 28, I think, votes. It was defeated something like 43 to 28. In 1934, there were 28 senators who were ready to say that the free market is not sufficient because bad money drives out good.
Right.
Today, I don't think you'd find 28 senators to have that discussion, and I think that's a pity.
Yeah. Well, just think about all of the ballyhooing that a lot of broadcasters go through about serving, what is it, the public convenience, necessity, et cetera, et cetera.
That's the language of the 1934
That's right.
Public and interest, convenience, and necessity.
And that is, what, generally speaking, not the case.
Well, as Frank Stanton, then president of CBS, once said at a congressional hearing, anything the public is interested in represents the public interest.
Yeah.
Well, this is a laughable proposition.
Mm-hmm.
If that were true, then there cannot be any small r Republican or small d Democratic life in the United States.
Well, what you're telling me is that the gatekeepers are not necessarily asleep at the gate, but they're awake in the wrong direction.
They're awake for doing one basic thing.
Making money.
Yeah. Or trying to.
Yeah.
Now, what my book on the prime time business shows, though, is that the fact that they want to make money doesn't necessarily mean that they're altogether that good at it.
Yeah.
The fact that they have to deal with all the time is that they don't know what's going to succeed.
Yeah.
And most of what they do fails.
Right.
Just as most movies fail in the box office and most plays fail and so on.
Well, let's conclude our conversation on that, Todd Gitlin. Speaking of making money, tell me about this section in your book, Watching Television, about commercials. Everybody's favorite whipping boy. We have great fun with them. Let's begin with this. Is there any virtue to commercials on American TV? Is it all weakness? Is it all nothing but the object of criticism? Help me with that.
No, actually, in fact, some people would say it's the finest form on television because actually more money per second goes into making it than anything
uh-huh.
else. So in some technical way,
yeah. They're
actually, you know, supreme television. I wrote a piece about car commercials in Miami Vice.
Uh-huh.
And I use them...
Now, wait. You don't mean just the car commercials on the program,
no.
Miami Vice. You mean
no.
car commercials and...
In fact, a specific kind of car commercial. And
okay.
It's the kind in which there's a very wham-bam, high-speed movement of the car, which is whizzing through open space somewhere in the mountains, in the desert. It's crunching on the gravel. It's on the mountaintop. It's even taking off into space. And there's this go-getter, who
yeah.
I called the lone driver, almost always a male, guy, you know, with a lot of velocity, very kinetic. He gets the girls.
You make me think of a movie that Barry Newman made called Vanishing Point. It's about a guy who is this lone driver. It's all power.
Well, and part of what I did in the piece is to show how this figure is rooted in American culture. I mean, this
mm-hmm.
doesn't come up simply in the late 20th century. We've been living with this sort of mythic figure. He's rooted in the hunter and the frontiersman and James
yeah.
Fenimore Cooper's people
right.
and so on. I see this as like so many other phenomena of this period, as representing a kind of blankness of expression, a focus on surfaces, and a kind of childish dependency on technology as a liberating force, which is very naive.
You think this is a bad thing?
I think it is a bad thing, although I think it's also extremely widespread thing. I think we should be asking, what is being lost in this process?
Mm-hmm.
What is the bedrock? How do we preserve a sense of the real? I don't mean to be alarmist about it, but I think that, for example, at a time when an American president can propose that a non-existent technological apparatus is somehow going to deliver us from the danger of nuclear weapons, clearly the sort of phenomenon that I'm talking about is not simply some idle and marginal thing.
Mm-hmm.
This technological fix in the form of Star Wars represents, I think, a kind of innocence which is deeply built into American culture for a long time.
And wait a minute now, I'm going to pick a fight with you. Did I just catch you in a bad analogy there? I mean, there's a big leap between blankness and technology on Miami Vice and television car commercials and for good or ill, what the scientists are telling us about Star Wars.
What they have in common is a wishfulness that American prowess can be preserved from harm, from difficulty, from contamination, from complexity, if it is sufficiently guarded.
Mm-hmm.
It is, and the idea of the rainbow shield that is going to rescue us,
mm-hmm.
I think it represents a similar sort of innocence. The idea of the car that can take you anywhere, that the computers that can think everything out. This is more complicated than obviously we have time to go into at this point. But suffice to say, I meant the essay as a provocation. So mm-hmm. if it provoked you, I'm happy.
Fair enough. Todd Gitlin, a real quick footnote to our conversation here. You are the editor of Watching Television, a new anthology. What do you like to watch on TV? What's your favorite program? And give me a half a minute on why that might be.
There was a time when I watched more than I did when I was writing a book on how the stuff is produced. I think the show I watch most regularly now in prime time is Cagney and Lacey.
Mm-hmm.
I've become increasingly interested in Donahue, although I don't usually get to watch it during
the day. The great therapist.
Well, I'm actually interested more in his role as a political instigator. I think mm-hmm. actually there's more. Wild, in the healthy sense, political cantankerousness on his show than you'd find in McNeil Lehrer. I think there's a much wider range of possibilities in Donahue's world. I like Cagney and Lacey because it honors the difficulty of living in cities these days. I mean, I think living in cities is very hard, and a show that I believe that television is at its most noble, if that's not a perverse word in this context, when it honors the rough edges. There are not happy endings. Crimes are not necessarily solved conclusively. Cops have got a lot of problems. They're human. The families are difficult. They drink, etc.
Todd Gitlin is a professor of sociology at the University of California at Berkeley. He's the editor of a collection of essays, Watching Television, published by Pantheon Books. Todd Gitlin participated in a recent conference at the National Humanities Center on television and history. His most recent book is The 60s, Years of Hope, Days of Rage, published by Bantam Books. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. For a cassette copy of Soundings on Television and American Culture, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings would like to hear from you. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about history, art, and patronage in India. My guests will be two scholars who recently completed fellowships at the National Humanities Center, Brijan Goswami of Punjab University and Barbara Ramusak of the University of Cincinnati. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Watching Television. That's the topic this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center. Soundings this week features Todd Gitlin, a critic of American media from the University of California at Berkeley. According to Todd Gitlin, for good or ill, television is a fact of American society. Watching Television, some answers and insights this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.